Welcome to the Boston College Chief Executives Club podcast of the April 23rd, 2020 forum featuring Dr. Tony Coles, Chairman and CEO of Cerevel Therapeutics and Chair of Humanity Therapeutics. I'm Warren Zola, the Executive Director of the Boston College Chief Executives Club. The Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management, is one of the top-ranked CEO speaking forums in the world. Several times each year, Boston's business leaders gather to learn from CEOs of global companies, leaders from the top echelons of their fields who welcome the opportunity to address an audience of their peers. Tony joined us for a series we call Conversations with CEOs as he spoke with me, and we engaged in a Q&A with our members. The conversation focused on the medical community's response to COVID-19, when we can hope to have a vaccine, and how companies are collaborating on various solutions to the pandemic. Please enjoy this podcast of the Boston College Chief Executives Club. So again, thank you, Tony, for joining us and for all of our members for taking an hour out of your day to sort of rebuild the community that we started here with the Boston College Chief Executives Club.
Pleasure to be here, Warren. Thanks.
And you are in Charleston, South Carolina, if I'm not mistaken.
Just outside of Charleston. We're on Keough Island, which is where we have a family home, and joined by my wife and our three grown sons.
Excellent. Excellent. And you missed the couple of inches of snow we got this past weekend. So, I don't want to hear what the weather's like down there today.
No, you don't actually. So, but I'm very sorry. I'm very sorry for you. So.
Well, we're excited. It's going to break 50 today. So, yay Boston. So I'm going to just start off with sort of a simple question. Obviously there's a lot of topics to cover, and I do want to be respectful of everybody's time. We are planning on ending at 2 o'clock sharp. But since you serve as the chair of two biopharma companies, why don't you tell us just a little bit about those companies and what they do and how they're playing a role in sort of today's environment. And then we'll get into some more specifics.
So let me, first of all, thanks for having me. It's I gather the inaugural outing for the virtual town hall. So I'm really honored to be with you and be with everyone today. Let me start with that particular question by talking a little bit about my early days in Boston at Mass General, where I trained as a cardiologist. The reason I start there is it's germane to how I think about the biopharmaceutical industry, what our real mission is, what it is that we're trying to get accomplished, and how important it is for everyone in this industry to focus on patients. Now, I start there because not only because I'm a cardiologist and I took the Hippocratic Oath, but there's an opportunity then to turn to what I do every day for a living, which is to discover new therapies and try to bring the best available science directly to patients, to really remind myself that there's some really big problems we have. You know, I've been doing this for 30 years. So I remember when HIV/AIDS was a nearly fatal or lethal disease in 95% of the cases. I remember when the mortality from cardiovascular disease was so high that it was a much more devastating disease than it is today. And I can certainly remember when cancer was nearly a universal death sentence for people who were diagnosed. In each of those cases, that's now no longer the case. And that's really owing to the advances of science. But the next great frontier is neuroscience. So diseases of the brain, such as Parkinson's, Lou Gehrig's, Alzheimer's, we are in this moment essentially where HIV/AIDS, cardiovascular disease, and cancer were 30 years ago when I first joined this industry. And the science that we have access to today will bring us new promising opportunities. I chose this particular field, and I've been involved in all of the major disease areas. I chose the field of neuroscience intentionally because it has the greatest need and has the greatest problems, or the least about it. So this whole notion that we identify new therapies to treat these diseases is really, really important. So Humanity is the company I co-founded with Dr. Susan Lindquist, who was a brilliant scientist and a neurobiologist at the Whitehead Institute. And she had a particular insight that we could use yeast to try to understand the biology of certain brain diseases. And that company, Umanity, now, 5 years later, has one brand new therapy in human trials for the treatment of Parkinson's. And this is really important, and it's landmark, because it's not just the improvement of the symptoms, it's treatment of the underlying disease. We have another program for Lou Gehrig's disease, and these are areas where we never really thought we'd have anything tractable within our lifetime. And I think we may have some breakthroughs on the horizon. Cerevel, the other company, complements what Umanity does because it is focused on treating the symptoms of these diseases, Parkinson's, epilepsy, schizophrenia. It's a Bain portfolio company. These were the assets which came from Pfizer. Sponsored and committed capital to these to grow them. So from symptom improvement to disease modification and treatment, we're covering the landscape with both companies.
That's fantastic. And so, you know, clearly you've got two companies that you're involved with. I know you're involved with more, but how are these companies collectively responding and collaborating in response to COVID, right? Because it's not going to be one company that's going to have this breakthrough. We're going to need this collaboration across the board. And how do you see it from your vantage point through a couple of companies in the other connections that you have? What sort of collaboration do you see in this industry?
So there are lots of collaborative opportunities, but let me address the specific point about COVID, and I'm sure we will talk more about that. Many of us have been hearing about therapies and the lack thereof for the coronavirus, this novel coronavirus, the COV2, as it's called. There are lots of therapies, namely the idea that there is an antiviral, perhaps, or a vaccine, and we can talk more about the difference between those two. Or if you're unfortunate enough to have been infected and have lung problems, which we know is commonly one of the symptoms of this particular virus causing so much death, there are drugs that are just being used to treat the lung symptoms of this particular disease. I start with that framework mostly to make the point that while neither Umanity or Cerevel, the two companies I'm involved in, have a focus on infectious diseases or viruses, there are a number of companies that are working on the forefront of trying to bring a new vaccine forward for the coronavirus, or a new antiviral forward, or something that will treat the lung disease that's associated with it. Now, for full disclosure, I'm a member of the board of directors of Regeneron Therapeutics, which is one of the companies that has two of these therapies in development. One is a vaccine that's under development, and the other is to treat the lung disease. And I just want to disclose that because I'm going to talk about all the therapies even-handedly, but I wanted everyone on the call to at least be aware of that. The kind of collaboration that's happening beyond the scientific innovation will ultimately come when we do find a treatment, either a vaccination, an antiviral, or a non-targeted therapy to help improve the organ damage of this disease, will likely come on the manufacturing side of things. Because A, we've got to figure out which therapy or therapies work, what the right combination is, but very importantly, we've got to be able to move very quickly to manufacture enough supply, not just for the US, but likely for the world. And that's where collaboration is really going to be needed.
Yeah, I was reading something recently. I can't remember what it was. I'm sure it was obviously online, about something that it was a couple of CEOs who were talking about that they were surprised happily about the fact that for the first time in certainly recent years, everyone around the globe has sort of one concept, and we've got to fight this disease. And they felt that the collaboration around the globe from all these companies that might be competitors in other environments were actually pulling together and saying, how do we harness our resources as a human race to ensure that we're able to do what we can to protect ourselves with these new developments that we're going to need in the near future for society to come back to normal?
Yes, it's a really important point, because what we know is that no one approach is likely going to be effective, and we are going to all have to do this collectively. Cerevel and Umanity are both doing their part by halting our ongoing human trials across the globe to make space for the urgent need of clinical trials for the coronavirus. Many of the academic institutions, including Mass General and others, have suspended all other clinical trials so we can focus everything on the coronavirus. And I think that's very, very appropriate.
So yesterday, Barack Obama used his social media platform to share a link to an article written by Jim Yong Kim in The New Yorker. And the article is titled, quote, "It's Not Too Late to Go on the Offense Against Coronavirus." And in it, he outlines five elements that weapons needed to beat COVID: distancing, tracing, testing, isolation, and treatment. And what was interesting about this in the article, and Barack Obama mentioned this as well, was that they called out Massachusetts for one of the leaders in the states of moving forward on all five of these efforts. Do you agree that these are sort of the elements that are needed to be in place for society to reopen on a large scale? And if so, sort of how are we in that process? How far away do you think we are until we're able to go to work in some normal format?
So this is, it's a slightly longer answer. And
we have 5 minutes, that should be plenty.
Okay, I will be compact, and then maybe we leave some of the unexplored areas for questions a little bit later. But here's the framework. So I have a degree in public health and am trained there, and it's one of the reasons I joined the biopharmaceutical industry and left the practice of medicine. But what I'd like to say is that at the beginning of any epidemic, or in this case, a pandemic, what you'd ideally like to be able to do is to contain the virus in as small a population as possible. And many people listening to this will know that that's the first objective. Containment is only possible if you've got adequate testing for those who are affected. And if you can do what we're now popularly, or what we're popularizing, contact tracing. Contact tracing is this whole notion that if you have an index case of the infection and you want to identify each person that has come in contact with that index case, and then over a very short period of time, isolate that person very quickly, test that person, and then ensure that you can contain or limit the spread of the virus. We unfortunately missed the opportunity to do that with the coronavirus. There might have been an opportunity for us to do that in the very early days, but there was such poor information and such a poor understanding of this virus, because it's the first time we've seen this particular virus in humans, that we didn't really know what we were dealing with. So once you've missed the window for containment, which requires testing and contact tracing as its two foundational aspects, you're then moving into a mitigation phase. So we are now living with the mitigation aspect of the public health management of this virus. And mitigation, of course, is never ideal, because it generally means that there is community spread and you can't actually adequately trace the index case or the number of exposed cases very easily. As we've learned more about this virus, we know it's difficult to characterize. We're learning more every single day, both about how it infects people, how long it lasts on surfaces, but importantly, which organs it affects as well. So we've heard a lot about the lung involvement, but there are now reports that the heart, the liver, the kidneys can all be involved. And so this is a brand new area for us. So making sure that we learn as much as possible is going to be key. So part of your question was, well, when might we be able to get back to normal? And I'm going to boldly say, I don't think we'll ever go back to normal. I think we should consider the equivalent of what the TSA brought us after 9/11. It forever changed our lives. Mm-hmm. Our lives will forever be changed as a result of this. I can't predict how or in what form, and I'm not suggesting that there's another large government infrastructure to help us manage this. We know we need some governmental response for coordination, for resource planning, and to ensure that we can get adequate information out to our citizens. But in some way, our lives are going to change, if only because we are all now digital natives, whereas before all of this, it was only our kids who were the digital natives. We've all very quickly become tech-enabled, and there will be a measurable sociological impact on the workforce, I'm sure. But the comment that I'd like to make is that in order for us to get back to some semblance of normal, some new normal, and to come out of our homes, we're going to try to, after the community transmission phase of this, mitigation phase, has adequately brought the number of cases under control, we should try to return to some semblance of a containment strategy. After the number of cases goes down, where the cases become farther and fewer between, if we can return to adequate testing for everyone and contact tracing for a smaller number of cases, we might be able to manage this in a better fashion. That, of course, has to go hand in hand with a therapy, either a vaccination or a vaccine or an antiviral regimen, which will help us to control either the spread of the infection or what happens once people are infected. So those are some things to look out for on the horizon as we try to think about life as the new normal.
Yeah, and I very much understand, you know, I think you're right. We all acknowledge that, you know, life will never be the same. We're not quite sure what that world will look like when we come out of what we've endured, continue to endure, but clearly things will be different. And I do want to mention to everybody, we are going to open up around 1:30 for member questions, but I've got a couple more for Tony right now. And you've mentioned a couple of times either sort of antiviral or vaccine. I was wondering if you could tell us just a little bit more about sort of the differences and what does that mean for us as we think about COVID from our living rooms watching each other on Zoom.
Sure. So this is one of my favorite topics, and it's really important, I think, to draw this distinction. I'm a member of the board of the Council on Foreign Relations, and we first had this conversation with the membership of the council a few days ago and repeated it for state and local government officials just Tuesday. And I start there because we on TV and whatever our news source is, we all hear about therapies. You know, we need a treatment, we need a therapy. But there's a real big distinction, and there are, as I said in the early comments, three different types of therapies. The goal of the first type of therapy is to prevent the infection in the very first place, and that is, of course, what a vaccine does. If you're vaccinated and you can mount your body's own immune response, then you can effectively prevent the infection in that individual who's been vaccinated. And there are lots of cases for this. The measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, the hepatitis vaccines, hepatitis B vaccines, innumerable examples of the way vaccines have been used to control the spread of infectious diseases. There are two types of vaccines. One is a live attenuated vaccine where you take the virus itself or portions of the virus and its genomic material. You inject it at the attenuated version of that into a human being, and you let the person's own immune system rise up, develop antibodies so that if presented with the virus in life, their own antibodies can actually fight the infection and prevent it. This is really critical to the development of herd immunity, which is a separate topic, but I referenced there because you need sufficient numbers of people who have their own immune response and can fend off the virus. The other type of vaccine is a passive vaccine where you inject antibodies that are manufactured outside of an individual's body, but they're directed against the virus and you inject those antibodies into a person. So they're not their own antibodies per se, they could be the antibodies generated from a person who's recovered from the coronavirus, so-called convalescent serum antibodies. And with this, you can effectively stop the spread of the infection if you've got the right antibody response by injecting these into the body. And when the virus presents, it's not an individual's own immunity, but an external immunity or what's called a passive immunity or antibody-mediated therapy. This works very effectively and it can work. And in fact, back in the 18th century, this was how William Jenner first treated smallpox when that was the epidemic of the day would do this and pass on the convalescent serum of people who had recovered from smallpox to people who had not been infected yet. So it's a tried and true mechanism. What we don't know is how susceptible the coronavirus will be to any vaccine, whether it will mutate and escape the immune response, and we just don't know, but we've got to present several options for the kind of vaccine we want. antivirals are different. They're the second type of therapy that we should be thinking about. And they're different because in the first case with a vaccine, you're trying to prevent infection. With antivirals, you're trying to minimize the infection because a person's now been infected and you want to minimize the spread of the infection. Viruses work within our body by essentially hijacking our own DNA and RNA systems and incorporating their virus and taking over our cells' ability to replicate DNA and RNA. So we essentially become a factory, a virus factory, for the production of more virus. If you can break that without harming the patient and stop the body's response to the virus and shut down the factory, then you have what's called effectively an antiviral. You've essentially hijacked the virus's hijacking of our own system. And this is commonly used as the approach for the treatment of hepatitis C, for HIV. And there are lots of examples where antivirals are given to individuals to break that cycle of replication and minimize the treatment of disease. These two are targeted therapies, so they're directed primarily at the virus or at the body's immune response generation. And the third category is a non-targeted therapy. It speaks to decreasing the body's response to the virus, because once you've been infected and the virus has replicated and infected the lungs or other parts of the body, a massive immune response is created. So this third type of therapy, and this is where sarilumab from Regeneron comes into play, this third type of therapy actually decreases the body's own immune response. So you're mitigating the response of the virus and dampening the very destructive immune response that this virus causes. So two targeted approaches, one non-targeted approach. I just want to go back to the antivirals really quickly with some updates, because we do have late-breaking news from Gilead, where its antiviral remdesivir in the last week has actually demonstrated significant benefit in 53 patients. Two-thirds of those patients actually shortened their course and improved their response. And in an ongoing study that they have underway, researchers at the University of Chicago yesterday actually reported that for their portion of this study, it's a 2,000 patient study, but Chicago had just over 100 of those patients. Those patients were actually able to decrease the length of time for the fever, decrease the severity of the symptoms, and be discharged from hospitals within 5 to 7 days or so. So there is some hope in the nearer term for an antiviral, because if this is all true, we should know very soon. Then we have to shift to manufacture and providing capacity for the world, which I mentioned was a really important part of collaboration.
That's great. I mean, I hadn't heard some of that stuff. And to, you know, even these small wins in today's society seem to be monumental in terms of helping us with our outlook and with our daily, you know, ability to sort of get through our days and think that at some point we will be able to come together physically as a community. Can you speak a little bit about the color of COVID? I mean, that seems to be, there's a disproportionate rate of this virus hitting people of color, the black and brown communities. Is that accurate? And B, can you just tell us a little bit about what you've heard and learned about that?
Sure, it's absolutely accurate. And let me share some statistics with you. In Michigan, for instance, where the black population is 14%, the incidence of a death from the coronavirus is 50% in the black population. So 14% of the cases and 50% of the deaths. In Chicago, for instance, where the black population is 30%, they account for 50% of the cases and 70% of the deaths. So we know that in many places where there's a disproportionate African-American population, the incidence of death in those locales are somewhere between 60 and 70% by our best guess and our best estimate. So it does mean that this disease is disproportionately affecting people of color, and in particular, black people. Now, what we know about that is this is a virus that preys on people who have comorbid conditions such as diabetes, hypertension, other ailments that involve or impact their ability to fight disease. And it selects these people, and what we have known for many, many years, that there is a disproportionate incidence of comorbid conditions in the black population. We also know that there's an uneven standard in terms of the access to health and healthcare for Black Americans for a variety of reasons, and this is very well documented. But there's a point I'd like to make in this. One, while most of us are able to socially distance ourselves from our workplace and from other people, most people who live on the margins and who don't have the resource can't do that. They've got to take public transportation to work. They can't afford to miss a paycheck. So they are every day putting themselves in harm's way. What's more is that 9 of the 10 lowest paying critical service or essential service jobs that are on the front lines of this virus are held by Blacks. 9 of 10. And wow. So we're counting on them to help us in the hospital. 40% of the jobs for nursing and provider support, orderlies, et cetera, are held by people of color. So not only is there a disadvantage because of the incidence of comorbid conditions, but there's an inability to socially distance because of the nature of the work many people have, and we're counting on them in the highest need essential service areas. So there's a triple whammy that's impacting the Black population. And we could also have a very, very good conversation about those states in the Southeast where Medicaid hasn't been expanded, because the population of Blacks in this country, 65% of Blacks live in the upper Midwest, the Northeast, and the Southeast. And as we know, most of the Southeastern states haven't expanded Medicaid. But think about the difference in comorbid conditions in those Southeastern states that didn't expand Medicaid 10 years ago. And think about what would have happened if they had, and the benefit that those populations might have 10 years later.
It's becoming more obvious as we sort of watch the news and we watch sort of how different states are responding, right? And you're beginning to see a pretty big split between, I'll call them sort of generically red and blue states. You know, Georgia, we're going to be able to go bowling and get haircuts tomorrow, at least in theory. So there's becoming a divide, not only sort of socioeconomically, but also geographically in this country. And that sort of concerns me in terms of what we're going to do as we come together to heal moving forward. My last question before I open it up to the audience. Senator Ron, you're a CEO, right? You're running companies. You've had that role before. In an interview from a couple of years ago, you're quoted as saying, quote, your job as a CEO is to remove barriers and find ways to accelerate what your employees are doing. How do all of us as leaders, or at least our members as CEOs, how do you do that virtually? How do you do that to make sure that the people that work with you or under you feel that they are playing an important role and that you're continuing to provide opportunities and leadership from your couch in your pajamas via Zoom and email?
You know, it's an interesting question, because as a leader and as a student of leadership, the files for what to do and what not to do as a leader are just brimming as I watch the nation's response to what's happening. And it's actually very interesting. It's very clear where good, strong leadership is. And I think if you look at those examples, you find transparency, you find consistency, you find data-based conversation, you find the willingness to say what we know and what we don't know, all of the things that we'd expect as human beings, because we just want as many answers as we possibly can. And we want to believe that there is someone who is managing this public health crisis, who not only has our best interest at heart as the number one and the only focus, but who's also going to be data and evidence driven. And I say that as a physician. I've reduced this now to my quick axiom of this is about data and not dates. Yep. And I think that's a really important place for us to be, that we've got to be data driven. So if you shrink that to the levels of responsibility that we all have in running companies or organizations, I think the lessons are really very clear. Say what you know, say what you don't know, do it on a frequent basis, and reassure individuals that when you have new information, you'll share that. We've been doing a series of virtual town halls with the entire employee population of the company. They've been overwhelmingly received positively, because people just want to know. If they don't see you or they don't see me for a few days, they say, well, what's going on? Or what? And there is a certain level of this creeping sense that there's no one really in charge, and that would be the worst thing possible. Obviously, many of us are having to look at our businesses and make cost containment and cost cutting measures, because we don't really know how long this will last and whether we'll be able to, in our case, access the public markets and any of those things. So we've got to take those clear business decisions. But the softer things, the EQ things, can never be underestimated.
All right. Well, thank you for that. And you know, it's always interesting to find out how different people are handling their role of leaders sort of virtually. And those are conversations, at least the CEO Club will continue to have. I think that they're going to be valuable for all of our members. I am going to turn this over to the audience for questions. I'm going to let Lauren handle turning off people's microphones to do things. And we'll go from there. So does anybody have questions? And if so, let's see what Tony has to say to share his insight.
I have a question. If somebody needs to go first, I'm happy to.
Go ahead.
Hi, Tony.
Hi.
So my question is around the life sciences industry specifically, right? You mentioned some of the collaboration and the collective efforts that have been going on. We've seen Pfizer open up its R&D platform, you know, really to become almost like an open source R&D community asset, right, from a lab perspective to the small biotechs. Everybody's skipping, you know, peer review on publishing and just getting out there, all good things. And, you know, I'm seeing that happen, and I have a flashback to 1990 when the defense industry needed for the first time ever to work together, right, or 1989. Which then accelerated the consolidation and the reshaping of the defense industry in the 90s, because they had worked together, you know, in a way they never had before. It would have been anti-competitive, a lot of what happened in the early 90s, right? And my question is, do you see, how do you see a possible evolution of drug development and or the life science industry as a result of, let's assume there's a success somewhere, right? Go forward a year, we're going to look back and say, remember when we worked that way together, everything was faster, better, smoother, et cetera. What do you think will stay with us in the life science sector through this change, if anything?
I think there are two things I can imagine. One of the reasons that Regeneron has moved as quickly as it has is that there was a very enterprising scientist within the organization who just had the insight that coronaviruses might one day be important. So over the last 3 or 4 years, he's been working on coronaviruses as scientists do to pursue their interests. Right. I think what this is going to do is raise the general question about viruses and other communicable organisms that could endanger the health and the safety of the population. We've largely never had to deal with this particular question. We've reasonably characterized those viruses that impact humans, and we've got a pretty good understanding of them. We got surprised with SARS in 2003, we got surprised with MERS, but fortunately, those two things, also both coronavirus types, were self-limited and burned out before we actually had the situation that we have today. But I think this is going to help us understand that there are a number of viral pathogens that can cross vectors from animals to humans. And we really better think about how we catalog those and really have a much better understanding of what our appropriate therapeutic response should be to those. So that's one. The second way that I can see an impact is actually in creating flexible manufacturing capacity. And what I mean, we can obviously have the conversation around trade and what this will do to the global economy and whether people will now onshore production capacity in general. But my comment is very specific to the manufacture of therapeutics, because thinking about trying to scale something for the globe is a really different order of magnitude than trying to scale something that will affect 1% or 2% of the population of the United States. And as a result, I suspect, and if we had a company that had this at manufacturing capacity, I would ask the team to put together a plan that would allow us to always hold in reserve some capacity in the event that we needed to scale that capacity very quickly and flexibly, even if we weren't using it for that, but just to build the plan that would give us the flexibility to, as quickly as we needed to, whether it's for a large molecule like an antibody or a small molecule like a tablet or a pill that you put in your mouth, just create the flexible capacity so that we can respond as quickly as we might need to. Hopefully this happens once every 100 years, but if we find ourselves confronting another pathogen in 5 or 10 years, I hope we will have learned some really valuable lessons.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do we have other questions from any of our members?
Yeah, Tony, what are your thoughts on the timing for a vaccine?
I think if we go back to the conversation around the two types of vaccine, I think a live attenuated vaccine is probably not on the horizon for 12 to 18 months. Most of that has to do with the fact that we want to get the mix of live versus dead or the attenuation or which virus particles are going to be important. We've got to get that right. And we've got to figure out the essential ingredient that's going to have the highest efficacy. One of the unknown questions with this particular virus is whether, if you are vaccinated, whether it can mutate sufficiently and escape the body's own immune response even after you've been vaccinated. And that we just don't know. But that's going to be a very important question that has to be tested and understood in the months to come. So for a variety of reasons, including the safety in the administration of a vaccine, it's going to take some time. And then you have the manufacturing and capacity questions on the back end of that before it's really ready to go live. I'm confident that the Food and Drug Administration will work with the manufacturers to speed the approval process once we've got adequate data. But I don't see that happening in under a year. A passive vaccine is quite a different thing. We should know much sooner about the possibility for a passive vaccine. There are several companies working on this. Vir Therapeutics is one. Regeneron also has a passive vaccine raised from convalescent serum and engineered mice that is being tested. And that Regeneron trial will start in June. It will enroll about 600 patients or so. And we should have the data from that study as early as late summer or early fall, because it can enroll very quickly and we'll know pretty quickly about the efficacy there. So a passive vaccine probably in 6 to 12 months, if we can address the manufacturing capacity question, and a live attenuated vaccine, which I think has a higher chance of working, 12 to 18 months or so.
That's great. Others?
Warren, can you hear?
Yep.
This is Jim. Warren, great discussion. Thank you. Tony, there's a theory or a belief out there, I think probably mainly by us statisticians, that herd immunity is, there are two ways to immunize a population. One is with vaccines, or the other substance you're talking about. The other is herd immunity, and that, and they believe that we took the wrong course, that by the time most quarantine measures were taken, populations in the various countries had already been exposed and had developed herd immunity. There was a study just this past week in Santa Clara County from Stanford, I'm sure you're aware of, that seemed to confirm that 50 to 80% of the population is already immune. What are your thoughts on herd immunity?
So there are two questions in there, and let's take them in turn. I know the data that you're referring to from California, which for everyone else, suggested that in a random sample of about 2,000 individuals, serologic testing suggested that 4% of the individuals in this random sample had been exposed to the coronavirus. Lots of questions. Of course, we don't know that it was this particular coronavirus, but let's assume that it was. The interesting thing there is, if you multiply that out and look at the specific impact on just take California, we have confirmed cases far below the 4% incidence that was observed in this particular study. So it suggests to us that there are lots of people who might be exposed, may even have very mild forms of the disease, and the lethality of the disease may not be as high as we believe, because the lethality is just a measure of the denominator of the number of positive cases confirmed. So if it's true that there have been cases that have been undetected by testing, the incidence is a lot higher, for instance, then that's probably the bright lining in this cloud. The problem with this particular data, and it's not the data itself, but it's the implication, is that if it's correct and nearly only 4% of the population have been exposed to coronavirus or had some form of the infection, it means that 96% of the population hasn't been. And most experts in this area believe that nearly 60 to 70% of a population need to be exposed in order for herd immunity to be created. The way herd immunity works is you just give the virus fewer targets of individuals, because if in a crowd of people, 60%, just to borrow that number, have had the infection already, and you put one index case, well, the only 40% of the people in that room who could then go on to get the virus, and not 96%, which is what the Santa Clara data suggests. So that's a big difference, because on our way from 4% to 60%, just imagine the number of deaths, the comorbidities, and how much we would overwhelm our already strained medical system. So net-net, I see the benefit, meaning that you can have the disease and it's not as virulent or as lethal as we might believe. But on the flatter side of that, I'm very worried about what would have to happen and what would have to be true in order for us to go from 4% incidence of exposure all the way up to 60%. And you could say, well, Tony, maybe it doesn't have to be 60, maybe it has to be 50. But we don't think we can get herd immunity at 20 or 30%. So it's got to be a big number. And that number, the incidence of cases there with the resulting death rate, even if it's lower, is something that I'm sure would really overwhelm our already strained resources.
We have time for a couple more questions before I go to a lightning round I've got prepared for Tony. We have a couple more.
Hi, Dr. Coles. Thank you so much. For context, I live one block from Mass General. I'm a former baby cuddler there.
Nice. Very nice.
And I also, and the babies were amazing. Some of them were, it was a drug issue. And so just precious little souls that I got to take care of. And I also did a talk for a Harvard School of Public Health on people skills, power, you know, my power skill is the people part. You talked about EQ.
Yes.
And the importance of that. I'm getting ready to speak to cardiologists this tomorrow. And there will be some women of color in there. And what are some practical, tactical things that these women, and particularly women of color, can do to forward their career, get some visibility, be sure that they are part of this conversation, as we need to have a diverse voice in this situation that is one so incredibly tender, and how can we practically move that conversation forward in a leadership fashion?
You know, I think it's a great question, because there is, I think, in every crisis an opportunity. I think it was Rahm Emanuel who once said, never let a good crisis go to waste. And I tend to subscribe to that perspective. I've, in fact, challenged my own executive team to create ways in which we will emerge as a different and stronger company because of what the what we're going through right now. So if I were to give anyone advice, I would say pursue the really interesting questions. Maybe it's someone who's very interested in what's happening in the African American community in terms of comorbid diseases and where the opportunity is to change that, just by way of example. Maybe it's a question around, well, how many novel coronaviruses are out there and how many should we really be studying or thinking about? So it can go from the clinical to the basic science to the research side of things. And the reason I suggest that is that if you find a really interesting question and you pursue it, it opens up a lot of avenues for you to become expert or to distinguish yourselves in a really important way and in a meaningful way that will return a benefit to society. And I find for anyone who wants to advance a career, since I think that's the thrust of your question, being able to find something that is both of interest and that's meaningful to society is a really key way to find the win-win for yourself and for society.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, pleasure.
Do we have some more questions?
I'd like to ask a question. So, doctor, tell us how we can go about providing advice to non-medical company CEOs to provide assurance and comfort to their followers that these challenges are being addressed, that the timing is unknown, and that we have to stay together and follow the CDC guidelines at work and at home in order to protect ourselves and others between now and the time that the hoped for solutions present themselves?
You know, there's that's another very good question, and it's mostly because we're living in an era where facts are relative considerations, and data doesn't always matter. And I think the best thing that a leader, whether it's a CEO or a state government official or a head of a particular state or governor, I think the most important thing they can do is strive to be evidence and data based. We may get it wrong, but it will be the best evidence and best data that we have. And so seeking that is going to be very important. The White House last week, as we all saw, issued a set of policy guidelines for reopening states, for instance, which suggested, and I'm not here to argue whether it's the right or the wrong advice, but suggested that 14 days after the peak number of cases or the incidence of cases in a particular state might be a time to consider selectively reopening. That was the guidance. Well, we have a very good example in the state of Georgia where it's only 7 days. So this isn't a time to either be arbitrary or to, for reasons other than the public interest and public safety, make decisions that very well may harm individuals, because as a leader, your first duty has to be to the public health and the public safety of the people who follow you and their care and consideration. So data, not dates, being evidence-based, and really asking the tough questions. It was quite interesting in this call with the state and local government officials who are the state legislature representatives or state senators. They were the public health commissioners from all 50 states plus the territories of the United States. It was really surprising how little information they had given the critical nature of the roles they all played. These were individuals who would be advising mayors and governors about reopening the state. And I could tell by the questions that were posed that they are just starved for information and really good information. So I'd say, do your research, get the facts, make reasoned judgments, but above all, just don't play around with people's lives, because that would be the greatest transgression, certainly for someone like me who took the Hippocratic Oath to first do no harm.
Tony, you mentioned sort of politics, and I know that you know in our conversations previously, you know, you've mentioned quite a bit about a PAC that you're involved with, that Joe Kennedy's involved with. Can you tell us a little bit about this political action committee that you're engaged with and what it's seeking to bring to society or address?
Sure. 3 years ago, in 2017, we actually formed the Black Economic Alliance. This is a group of Black business leaders and aligned advocates who saw an opportunity to really raise the alarm on the current economic conditions for Black Americans. Obviously, there are lots, you know, poverty knows no racial bound, obviously. But given some of the conversation we had earlier, there's a distinct set of problems that are a result of systemic inequities, sometimes federal legislation like redlining and the absence in participating in the Social Security Act in the 1930s that have really caused some entrenched patterns of inequality. Our goal is to actually focus on work, wages, and wealth, and for Black Americans, and by extension, anyone who would benefit from these, to address some of the systemic inequities, but also to ensure that there's a clear voice of advocacy as legislation comes forward, as policy is written, and at the elected official level, to ensure that these inequities are addressed with proactive policies. So we focus on jobs, jobs creation, and once someone has a job, getting a fair and a decent wage, and then using those two things as a pathway to wealth creation. So we are as focused on issues of job creation, workforce development, as we are minority entrepreneurship and the improvement of and the growth opportunity for Black businesses as well. So obviously we've been very, very actively involved in the last round of the stimulus package development with all of our contacts in Washington and across the country. We're working collaboratively with the private sector to ensure that organizations that are responsible for loaning money to Black businesses are shored up in this particular moment, because those are the businesses that have been most vulnerable. And in the first go round of the $2 trillion stimulus package, were not recipients in large part of those funds. So the Paycheck Protection Program that would have preserved jobs for Black businesses and their employees really skipped over. And this was a structural fault, which has now been corrected in the most recent legislation. Didn't allow for funds to trickle down or to get to Black businesses for a variety of reasons that we can talk about, but most importantly, that the organizations that loan money to Black entrepreneurs and Black businesses weren't eligible or weren't part of the banking syndicates where the PPP funds were being funneled. So we are focused on making sure, A, that the legislation gets signed, and it looks like it will get signed, and once signed, ways in which we can enrich the opportunity to make sure that money gets to where it's most desperately needed.
That's great. I hope after this event, you'd send me a link that I can share with our members. I know that you mentioned allies, and I'm optimistic that our membership can be supportive and an ally for this PAC moving forward. I do want to be respectful of everyone's time and this top of the hour. As I indicated initially, I've got a couple of lightning round questions. Maybe not as intense as talking about COVID and global issues that we've got, but let me just start off with something simple. What was the last book you read and did you enjoy it?
It was Where the Crawdads Sing. And I did. I really enjoyed it. Lyrical, transported me to a very different world, a world that I didn't really know. But because the topography here in the low country of South Carolina is marshy and somewhat swampy, it resonated. But it was a fascinating read, and talked a lot about resilience, which is something that resonates.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great book. Last album that you listened to, that you sought out for, maybe I'm dating myself when I say album, last playlist, some of the songs that you seek out.
You will be comforted to know that vinyl is coming back. So hopefully you didn't throw away your vinyl collection from the 70s and the 80s. So I enjoy a wide range of music. I'm thinking about this, and I worked out this morning to a 2000s workout playlist. So Usher was in there, Beyonce, Destiny's Child, Jennifer Hudson, Brandy. So I love R&B, but what I really love is what this Gen Z is actually doing with, you know, the R&B and the soul genre, and putting an indie spin on it. So you got some great artists like Ella May, you've got Daniel Caesar, you've got Ari Lennox, who are really kind of carrying forward the tradition. So as you can see, my tastes are really broad. Sunday, it's usually gospel, and then jazz, and you can find anything playing in our house.
Well, I'm glad we're recording this so I can go back and go through some of that stuff. It sounds like both the playlist of what I like to put on my Peloton when I'm trying to get a good sweat and workout in versus some of the stuff that I put in the background when I'm on my computer. I would also let everybody know that as soon as I'm done with this, I'm going to flip on WWOZ, which is a New Orleans radio station, and they're broadcasting the greatest hits from the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival over the next 4 days. So feel free to stream that as well. What was your first paying job?
McDonald's. I worked at McDonald's in the fast food business and learned some of my most valuable lessons about how hard some people really have to work, because that is really hard labor. I will tell you, but it gave me an enormous sense maybe an empathy with the daily existence of the people we try to serve through the PAC today. So I'm really grateful for that. I was really grateful for the money because it helped me to pay for college and buy my clothes. So it was quite an experience, though.
And if you could have anybody in the world today living join you for dinner, who would it be?
You know, I'll give you the cliche answer and the cliche answer, but then I have another answer for you. The cliche answer is the Dalai Lama. And I'm fascinated by him because to the extent that he's transcended nearly everything that we think about on a day-to-day basis and that we stress and that we worry about, I want some of that. I want to understand that. And that, if you will, that universal or that cosmic sense of the real meaning of our existence, and to bring that more present into the work that I do every day. But the other answer is because there are lots of really interesting people all over the world. And you know, I thought about all types, you know, people who are heroes and anti-heroes and people who are antagonists as well. But I rested on a person whom I don't know, and none of us do. And that's the person who would be president of these United States in 20 years. Because I'd like to sit with that person today, if we could identify who that is, and talk to that person about the issues and the systemic inequities and the challenges we face as a country, to get that person thinking today about the kinds of solutions that we'll need in 20 years to address those issues. Because I think taking a long view for some of the things that we have to confront is going to be very important. And if we wait until someone campaigns or, God forbid, they're elected, we've lost a lot of time. So I think 20 years is about the right head start.
Those are both great answers. The Dalai Lama is obviously certainly someone that I would like to have at a small dinner party myself. So, but I like your answer of thinking about the future, someone who's going to serve as our president in the future. I'm going to wrap up with this one last question or request. If you could give us a message of hope, something that can that we can all leave today, sort of remember, put a smile on our face, remember that we're part of this community together. Is there anything that you could offer in those regards?
This will end. It will absolutely end, although it seems daunting by its simple prospect. And it will end because of persistence and just human ingenuity. And what I hope through all of that is that as we're waiting, that we're contributing positively, but we're also really focused on the things that matter. And I'm challenged in my own life to always remember what really matters. You know, sitting in front of a Zoom camera doing whatever it is I do is important. People count on me, but it's not all that matters. And if I don't learn that lesson, then I will have squandered this social isolation time.
Well, if our members don't take some learning and some notes from today's discussion, I think they missed an opportunity. So let me start off by thanking all of our members for joining us in our first virtual town hall. A reminder, we are going to try and do these about once a week. Our next one is a week from tomorrow with Bob Rivers, the chair and CEO of Eastern Bank. I know that Tony knows him and met him as well. So I invite you, we'll send invitations out to that about 2 days prior. So I appreciate everyone joining us. Thank you to Lauren and Gail, who helped me navigate technology. Hopefully this went off without a major hitch. So thank you to you too. But most importantly, Tony, thank you so much for joining us. Your participation, your insight, your friendship has meant quite a bit to me personally and certainly professionally. So I hope the people here on this call join me in thanking you for giving up your time and for your leadership in the roles that you have, helping us fight the battle that we're currently in. So a deep thank you to you for your time and your effort and your work.
Well, Warren, it's been a real pleasure. I've enjoyed every minute of it. So thank you. Thank you for having me.
Wonderful. I hope everyone has a great day. Feel free, as we mentioned, to send emails to Lauren, Gail, myself, our account, with feedback, advice, recommendations. It's probably going to be a while till 300 of us join together in person at the Boston Harbor Hotel, but that doesn't mean that we should give up this community, the opportunity to learn from each other and to support each other. So once again, thank you to everybody for joining us, and I hope to see you soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast of the Boston College Chief Executives Club featuring Dr. Tony Coles, Chairman and CEO of Cerevel Therapeutics, and chair of Humanity Therapeutics. To learn more about the Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management at Boston College, please visit our website at www.bc.edu/CEO Club.